Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to today's Interested Persons meeting. My name is Nancy Jackson. I'm the Director of Strategic Communications at the Ethics Commission, and we are being joined today by Deputy Executive Director David Tristan, our Policy Director Tyler Joseph, and other members of the public, as well as some staff at the Ethics Commission. The purpose of this special meeting is to solicit public comment on the city's lobbying laws and the 2018 recommendations. To provide a bit of background, in 2018, the Ethics Commission recommended that the City Council adopt a comprehensive set of updates to the city's lobbying laws. The Municipal Lobbying Ordinance, MLO as it's known, had not been thoroughly updated since 1994, and the Ethics Commission spent 2 years conducting research and analyzing laws around the country. The Ethics Commission also extensively engaged the public during that review. Feedback was solicited and provided at 5 public commission meetings, 5 interested persons meetings, and 4 meetings with groups representing more than 65 neighborhood councils. The Ethics Commission also sent multiple emails to its more than 8,500 subscribers and created a page on its website to solicit public input. Because no legislative action was taken on the 2018 recommendations, they expired in March of last year. At its December 2020 meeting, the Ethics Commission expressed an interest in the possibility of a new set of lobbying recommendations and asked staff to solicit additional feedback from the public and regulated communities. So at this time, the Ethics Commission would like to hear from you. Please tell us what you think about the 2018 recommendations or the lobbying laws in general and how they apply to lobbying entities such as lobbyists, lobbyist employers, lobbying firms, development expediters, business improvement districts, nonprofits, et cetera. You may provide public comment here today or on the Ethics Commission's website at ethics.lacity.org/policy or by emailing us at ethics.policy@lacity.org. We will also be holding one additional special meeting for continued feedback tomorrow. For details, please visit our website at ethics.lacity.org/meetings. Again, the Ethics Commission would really like to hear from you, so thank you so much for being here. We welcome you, and at this time, I would like to turn it over to our Policy Director, Tyler Joseph, who will be providing additional guidance. Tyler.
Thanks, Nancy. Can everyone hear me okay? Nancy, we good on the audio?
Yes, Tyler, I can hear you. If you could just speak up a bit, maybe.
Sure, yeah. So, thanks a lot. My name is Tyler Joseph. I am the Policy Director with the Ethics Commission. I just wanted to say a quick thanks to everybody on the call today. Whether you were here yesterday for that meeting or if this is your first one, we appreciate you guys taking the time to call in and to give us your thoughts on this. The format is going to be really simple. It's essentially a public comment at a regular meeting. So what we're going to do here in just a minute is open this up, and we're going to give everyone who wants to speak a chance to do that, just as we would in your typical comment session. If you have any specific questions that you'd like to submit to us in writing, you can do that, as Nancy mentioned, through our website, or you can do that via email at ethics.policy@lacity.org. And we'll be happy to get back to you with detailed responses to anything that you might be wondering about. And as for today, both the staff and our commissioners would really like to know what you think about this. We're welcoming you to weigh in on anything you'd like to, any part of this proposal. And we're just going to essentially work through the commenters until everybody's had a chance to speak. So with that, we're going to get started. We're going to open it up, and Nancy will call on the first speaker. So thanks again for being here.
Great. Thank you, Tyler. So go ahead and get started with caller with phone number ending in 719. And before we do that, caller with 719 phone number, if you can stand by for instructions. If anybody else wants to raise their hand, I do see some hands raised here. If anybody else wants to raise their hand, please dial *9 to raise your hand and you will be put in the queue for public comment. Again, that is *9 to raise your hand. And caller with phone number ending in 719, please state your name for the record, and if you would not mind spelling that for us, that would be very helpful as well. Thank you.
Sure. It's Eric Previn, P as in Peter, R-E, V as in Victor, E-N as in Nancy.
Thank you, Mr. Previn. Please go ahead.
Right. I'm a resident from Studio City, and I have a little familiarity with the lobbyist ordinance and with the lobbyist community, who are doing an outstanding job. But let's just agree that they provide a vital, critical service, as Arnie Berghoff told me recently. And we just have to acknowledge that somebody needs to tell the politicians and the city council members, you know, sort of what to do and how to vote, and they're doing a good job. And they're very influential and inflexible, because what they're able to do is to apply lobbying funds at the county to a company like, say, Enterprise Rent-A-Car or Waste Management, and then solicit the return favor across the street down Grand Park at the city by the very same firm. So one idea for the lobbyist ordinance would be to track across jurisdictions, because it's not that far a walk. And, you know, I understand that you only look after city business, but the county is right there. It's got a almost $40 billion budget now. We're very concerned. Another thing is, and I think, you know, we can only do so much, but one area for shutting down a small loophole, and it's a lovely loophole, it's a very, very nice home-baked loophole, it's the homemaker spouse loophole, which is that lobbyists who are busy, very busy influencing city council members to make decisions, you know, for Taser, now Axon, or for American Golf Corporation, you know, but while they're trying to do that, they encounter opportunities for campaign contributions. But you can't do that if you're a lobbyist. So a wife or a husband of a lobbyist currently is not restricted from writing a little check for $800 on behalf of, you know, Mr. Berghoff. It's not on behalf of Mr. Berghoff, because nobody tells Linda Berghoff, the wife of Arnie Berghoff, exactly what to do, obviously, because she knows what to do herself. But it's very coincidental how she's given such an astonishing amount of money to all the council members, you know, and then we are left to guess which of Arnie's clients, you know, Corrette and all these guys are voting for. It's a bad area. It should be restricted, because if you're limited from giving, your spouse should also be limited, because otherwise we can't, you know, and no disrespect to the Sunkins and to the Knobbies and the Berghoffs. They're doing a lovely job. The third area, which is very important to me personally, is, and I know Heather, who has been replaced by David recently, after a 10-year term that it was astonishingly well played, you know, remembers that Greg Smith was a lobbyist. Well, at first he was a council member. Fair enough. He was a council member from CD12. But then he was a lobbyist for Waste Management. I mean, there's no question about it. He took money. He registered. He was a lobbyist. Then there was a confusion, I guess, because everybody thought, well, you can't, once you become a, you know, a lobbyist, you can't really serve exactly. Or there's a holdback on lobbying. I think that's what it is. It's when you become a council member, you can't lobby for a period of time until that. In any case, here's my point. We need clarity on these rules, because it's completely inappropriate. If someone can do it, if they just check to see if it's okay, then they say, yes, it is, but everybody else is barred from doing it. Now, this resulted, obviously, in the installation of a guy who I felt was a lobbyist, because he was, but they wanted to get him in there quickly. And the reason, and this is where it gets a little dirty, was because they were getting Englander out very quickly. Now, it seemed like one kind of thing where he had that fundraising meeting and everybody gave to him, and then the next day he said, oh, I want to be a lobbyist, and left. But now we know he was being chased by the FBI. So the whole thing, I have to say, leaves a bad taste. But let's get back to the good, strong work in this ordinance. I don't want to veer too far off course, but those are three very specific requests. You know, if I could urge the commission, I realize this is the staff who will deflavorize and present to the commission, but the commission will certainly have access to this. Take it seriously, because, you know, it does not make any sense to have loopholes that insult the public's intelligence. And, you know, the homemaker concept is just creepy. It's very easy to say, and your spouse cannot give to your clients either. Okay, that's not a First Amendment problem. It's okay. It's okay, because it's regulation. And, you know, I think the sooner we get there, the better. I appreciate you taking the time, and good luck. Wake up, Tyler. We're done.
Thank you, Mr. Previn. Caller phone with phone number ending in 384. 384. If you can go ahead and dial *6 to unmute, please, and state your name for the record, and if you can spell it for us, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Beverly Kenworthy, K-E-N-W-O-R-T-H-Y. I represent the California Apartment Association here in Los Angeles. We're a trade organization representing housing providers. I'd like to make some comments today, so thank you for taking them. Looking at some of the recommendations, some of them are very concerning. The level of detail required would be incredibly onerous to be able to fully comply with, not for any lack of intention to comply, but just, you know, I take a lot of phone calls. I sit in traffic a lot on my way to City Hall or to meetings. I get phone calls from council members, staff. I make phone calls during that time. You know, I'm not exactly sure how I would be able to realistically keep track of all of that, not because I didn't want to, but because I don't know how feasible that is. You know, we file our reports every, you know, time that we're required. We file them on time. We file them thoroughly. Our positions on issues are not a secret. We frequently give public comment. We write letters that are part of the public record. You know, a lot of times, I mean, something like, you know, a job title. Job titles are not universal across council offices. Sometimes they change without knowing. So those, I just don't see the public policy necessity for it. We just think that some of these laws are just, or these requirements would be increasing a burden without, I think, a good policy justification. I'm not exactly sure what it would do to increase transparency, since we're already required to report departments and the issues that we're lobbying on. It's already fairly burdensome, and we, you know, really have to prioritize already getting our reports in on time and making sure they're accurate. So I would hope that the commission sort of takes into account that, you know, the overwhelming majority of, you know, lobbyists and public interest groups are, you know, working in good faith and report what they need to. And the only purpose for some of these increased reporting requirements would just be an additional burden. And so I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We appreciate your time as well. So we'll be moving on to caller with phone number ending in 704. Caller with phone number ending in 704. If you can please dial *6 to unmute and state your name for the record. If you can spell it for us as well, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Chris Gambinski, C-H-R-I-S. G-E-M-B-I-N-S-K-I, and I'm a professional treasurer and compliance specialist. I prepare lobbying reports for a living, and I've done so for several years. And so I'll start off by saying that the current LA City filing system is actually one of the better lobbying filing systems in the state, and any kind of change or tweak to that electronic filing system kind of really makes me nervous, as the report is already very kind of burdensome and arduous to prepare, and I don't think a lot of people understand the amount of time it takes to already prepare our current lobbying report. So any sort of change to that electronic filing system, I kind of, like I said, it makes me a little nervous. Also, I just want to add that I think that if the commission wants to shorten the existing 30-day turnaround time, I think it can only make sense to reduce the amount of information that's required on some of these reports. As you know, like the previous speaker had said, you know, these lobbyists are constantly communicating with the officials, you know, while traveling and on their sending emails, writing phone calls, and to kind of change the amount of requirement, I think, not only change the amount of work that I have to do, but the amount of documentation and stuff that gets listed on the report also becomes the actual a big burden to me as well. So the 20-day turnaround time for completing lobbying reports, I think, is just not very practical, and I think it's going to lead to a lot less compliance and a lot more inaccuracies on a lot of these reports. And I also just want to add that I think that the public already learns much about the lobbyist activities by being told what the city department and the lobbyist, what the lobbyist is lobbying, and also I don't think that they need to know the exact names and titles of each employee in the department. Listing the city department and the city official contacted provides already adequate information to the public about the lobbying activities. And I think that, like the previous speaker had also said, asking lobbyists to add job titles and city employees is just very unnecessary and extremely burdensome, as job titles are always changing, and sometimes it's not very easy for the lobbyists to know the exact title of the person that they are contacting. And I really would hope that the commission would focus more on non-filers. There's a lot of people that are engaging in probably reportable lobbying that are not filing reports, and I think it should be on the commission to require more of those individuals to comply with the current laws. And I think that the commission should streamline reporting requirements in order to encourage more compliance. So I really want to thank you for this time. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. We will now be taking a comment from caller with phone number ending in 599. Phone number ending in 599. If you can please dial *6 to unmute. And please state your name for the record. And if you can spell it for us as well, that would be helpful. Thank you.
You bet. You bet. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Thank you.
Oh, terrific. I am Suzanne Hawley, and I'm the president and the CEO of the Downtown Center Business Improvement District, or the DCBID. My name is S-U-Z-A-N-N-E. Hawley is H-O-L-L-E-Y. Thank you very, very much to the commission for arranging for this opportunity to address you. So the DCBID is located in the 65 blocks of the Central Business District of downtown Los Angeles. We were formed pursuant to, we're a property-based bid, and we were formed pursuant to the business improvement, we were formed under California's Property and Business Improvement District Law of 1994. In that law, it was noted that businesses located and operating with the business districts of the state's communities are economically disadvantaged, are underutilized, and unable to attract customers due to inadequate facilities, services, and activities in the business districts. This was certainly the case when the DC bid started in 1998. The legislature also found that it is in the public interest to promote the economic revitalization and physical maintenance of the business districts of its cities in order to create jobs, attract new businesses, and prevent the erosion of the business districts. A particular benefit was to allow cities to fund business-related improvements, maintenance, and activities through the levy of assessments upon the businesses or real properties that benefit from these improvements. It therefore allowed property owners within specific boundaries to petition to a vote to be directly assessed to provide these services. So while we chose to form this organization, we're not a government agency. This came out of a significant need seen by the state for the private sector to be able to fund benefits for the public. There are over 40 business improvement districts in Los Angeles that assess nearly $50 million annually and nearly $600 million since the bid started in Los Angeles in 1996. So this is money that goes into these districts. This is money that doesn't have to come out of city coffers. Just to give you some sense of scope, in 2020 for all of the bids in Los Angeles, we removed 20 tons of trash. Like, we removed all the trash off of the streets in our district. The city didn't come in and do that. We removed 200,000 instances of graffiti. So we are taking this, you know, off of the city's financial shoulders. The state law further required that the funds collected from these assessments be administered and activities executed pursuant to a district management plan by a nonprofit association. So we're all nonprofit associations. The DC BID is the owner's association for our district. In Los Angeles, the owner's association for all the bids have a contract with the city to perform these obligations under the management plan. There's two buckets, basically, what we do. Clean and safe services in the public space, and then marketing economic development. So two-thirds of our budget is for clean and safe. And this includes trash removal, sidewalk cleaning, tree trimming, landscaping maintenance, and graffiti removal. These are some of the things that we do. There are often times that coordination of these services is required with the city via direct communication with the department, such as LA Sanitation, or by submitting a 311 request to the city's work order system. With regards to safety, we provide 24/7 dispatch center and deploy bike, foot, and vehicle patrol. But we are not sworn officers, and it's necessary for us to coordinate efforts with LAPD and share information on what's reported to us. But, you know, we believe that we are able to divert a lot of calls from having to go to LAPD. So, again, you know, saving those resources from having to be deployed to our district. So, in summary, we're an organization that is required by law to perform services that require us to routinely communicate with the city. So, outside of that, it's very common for city family members to reach out to us for feedback from the community. LADOT will ask for our assistance on coordinating, receiving input from properties specifically impacted by street improvements. City Council office may ask us for stakeholder feedback on programs like the scooter rollout. Our new council office has asked us to have a standing biweekly meetings with us to discuss district needs. LAPD will ask for input on activity in the district, which we observe. And that might not be reported on a police report. If people just get tagged in graffiti repeatedly, they might not, you know, call the police and let them know. We might also be asked to attend meetings by other organizations like CCA to provide feedback requested by the city for something like the Pershing Square improvement. So these are all instances where the city is soliciting feedback from us. And I'm sorry, excuse me, I've been ill, so I apologize if my voice has been too steady. I listened in on the call yesterday, and I was very happy to hear a comment. And I'm sorry, I don't recall exactly who said it. But that comment was that the communication with the city for the day-to-day operations of the bid would not be considered lobbying, like 311 requests. I mean, that was a relief. And just to give some background, this outreach from the bid community today and now stemmed from a flyer that was sent in July to the bids through the city clerk's office on behalf of the Ethics Commission. I've been with the DC bid for 7 years, and as far as I can ascertain, this is the first communication the bid community has received with regards to lobbying. And it was not very detailed, and there was one frequently asked question in particular that said, I work for a bid and I've had one interaction with a city council staff member regarding a bid issue. Since then, all I've done is conduct research and attend city council and committee meetings related to the issue. Am I required to register as lobbyists? And the answer was possibly yes. The interaction with the city council staff is a direct communication if it is included in an attempt to influence city action. So that's the question, is determining where's the line on city action. Nearly all of our communications with the city family can result in action of some kind. From yesterday's call sound like 311 requests to replace a light wouldn't fall under this. But if, you know, the concern is if we help provide feedback that the city requested, and then they take action based on that feedback, like maybe LADOT striping a bike lane differently, is this going to be considered lobbying? It's important to note that the lion's share of what we do is the day-to-day operations of the bid. Outside of that, our role is primarily focused on being a conduit between stakeholders and the city as needed on operational matters. I do want to make one point with regards to the DC bid. Our board took a vote earlier this year to not take any position on proposed developments in our district, so this is not something that we would weigh in on with the city. I think it's important to note as well that the DC bid provides quarterly reports to the city clerk to ensure that our activity is in compliance with the city council approved management plan. We're also subject to both the Brown Act and CPRA, so our actions are readily available to public scrutiny. Any requirement to require bids to complete what might be extensive reporting because our activities are misunderstood as lobbying could be, you know, duplicative and at the worst, very onerous. You know, while bids are not specifically included in the lobbying law as written right now, this just seemed like an ideal opportunity to provide some much needed clarification of what is considered lobbying for our unique organizations. So we're not subject to overly broad interpretations, which would ultimately not be a good use of the taxpayers' resources and not in the public's best interest. So I thank you. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you for your comment.
Nancy, actually, I wanted to follow up with Susan. I had a question for her. Susan, if you're still on the line. This is David Tristan. I'm the Deputy Executive Director. You had mentioned that in your case, and I don't want to generalize, so I'm not sure if all the bids work this way, but that typically you are asked for input from some city family member in terms of whatever the issue is, whether it's transportation, LAPD, sanitation. Mm-hmm. Are there instances where your bid or yourself or a representative of your bid proactively engage with the city on more substantive policy issues? Let's say, for example, the council member wanted to create a homeless center or open up some type of housing for individuals in the district, or a developer. I know you mentioned that they don't want to take any action on development, but if a developer did want to build a building in your district, or the city was thinking of adding bike lanes in your street, on those scenarios, and again, I ask this truly from wanting to gain an understanding, is because of the working relationship that you have with the city, when these issues come up, is it usually that the city contacts the bids ahead of time to communicate and get your thoughts, or is it more likely that this issue is brought up and you proactively reach out, or is it just a combination of both?
Thank you. It's David, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, David, thank you very much for asking. It really is overwhelmingly the city asking for our input. And we certainly on any, so there's kind of two different things that you talked about. You know, one was, you know, the city's activities or things the city's working on. So how would we weigh in on that? And then you talked about developers as well. So The development question, I'll take that first, was one that, you know, we wanted clarity on with our in our own board, and that's why we even brought it to a board vote. So we voted that we're not going to do that. we're not going to write a letter. We're not doing that. So if a development came to me, and this is for me, I'm speaking for my bid. If a developer came to me, I'd say I'm happy to see your presentation, but you know, there's no further role that we would take in that. And then, as far as the city activity, city family members are awesome, and they sincerely, I have felt, want input from the public, but what they have a hard time doing is connecting exactly to the impacted stakeholders. So I mean this is an example. LADOT was just, you know, they've done a lot of improvements this last year. They know exactly what properties are going to be more impacted, and they're doing this in a really, really tight time frame. They're trying to get it done, but they don't have contacts, and they say, okay, this building, we want to show these properties what's going to happen, who are the people. And I mean, we can get a meeting with those people, you know, in very, very short order. So we're working with the city. We're trying to help the city achieve its goals. So a lot of the times it comes in that direction. Pershing Square too. I mean, and that wasn't arranged from us. They had, you know, reached out to CCA to gather stakeholder feedback. So we were, you know, part of that process. We were requested for feedback. I'm trying to imagine a circumstance where we do something proactively, and I'm not saying that there isn't one, but I would have to say that that's not common, because I really do think that the city does a good job of trying to solicit feedback. So we're part of that process to assist them in doing so.
Okay. Thank you so much for that.
Okay. You bet. Thank you.
Caller with phone number ending in 274. Phone number ending in 274. If you can please dial *6 to unmute. And please state your name for the record. And if you can please spell it for us, that would also be helpful.
Yes. Hello. Can everybody hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
My name is Carrie McFadden. Carrie, MCF as in Frank, ADDEN as in Nancy. And I am calling this afternoon speaking as a professional political reporting specialist. I have been preparing and filing lobbying reports for various clients for the last 6 years since I've been at my current job. We file lobby reports throughout the state and in other states. We file at the state level here in California and in multiple local jurisdictions. I currently have two large LA City lobby firms as my clients, along with three lobbyist employers. And I am speaking specifically regarding the 20-day turnaround. I really think that is not enough time in order for us to obtain the information required to prepare these reports, particularly with some of the larger lobbying firms. Again, I'm speaking as someone who's been doing this professionally for almost 6 years. I consider myself fairly efficient, but it is still quite an onerous process just getting our lobbying clients sometimes to respond to us and confirm their activity. I believe some other speakers have talked about particularly requiring reporting of job titles. And I agree that that would be a lot more work, particularly a lot of the lobbyists don't necessarily know the exact updated job title. If they're speaking with 100 people a month, you know, it's a lot to ask them to also confirm all those titles. If they're not able to confirm them, then that leaves it up to us to confirm them. And again, requiring all of this within a 20-day turnaround, essentially every other month, would be a huge burden on us, on our clients, and on the reporting profession. I would require, or I would, you know, politely request that you all either, if you would like to shorten the time period of reporting and, you know, how often we file reports or how soon after the close of the period we're required to file reports, I would ask that you have there be less requirement to reporting and more, you know, less detail required, or just focus on us needing more detail, but keeping it at a 3-month level and you know, a full month to get the info. You know, we always strive to report everything as accurately as possible, and of course in a timely manner. But both increasing the amount of info that we have to report and increasing the frequency with which we have to report them is bordering on impossible for some of these clients. And again, I thank you all for your work on this. The current LA City lobbying system, the online filing system, is great. We have no complaints. We've loved working with Mark Lowe these past several years. So I guess that would be it. Thank you all again.
Carrie, this is David again. If you're still there, I had one quick question for you about that. One of the comments that we did receive last time around about the time constraints is that in a quarterly system, sometimes issues that come before council, you know, may be addressed within, you know, the 3-month window and then 1-month reporting timeframe. So you're talking about 4 months until the public sees potentially who was paid and who lobbied the council on something or a city department on a particular issue. How would you address that question in terms of potentially the public not having information on who lobbied and what they were paid for on a particular issue and only seeing that information once action is close to being completed or completed?
I think that, again, like this if you, I understand this struggle, of course, you know, it is hard when it's a 4-month turnaround and a lot of these items move through council, move through legislation quicker than that. But again, I would like to go back to just reiterating that if you do want to increase the frequency of reports being required, we would just ask that you lower kind of the requirements of what we need to file. In San Francisco, we're required to file on a monthly basis with a 15-day turnaround, but there is a lot, but we don't have to require, you know, we don't have to report the titles of the individuals and stuff like that. So I think we're just not too happy about both the frequency and the content of the reports increasing at the same time. We just worry about non-filing or people not being able to comply.
Okay.
Harry, this is Tyler Joseph, the policy director. I have one more quick question for you, if you don't mind. Thanks again for calling, and I appreciate you giving your thoughts so far. I know that you mentioned the job titles, which I think was Beverly and Chris also brought that up. Was there anything else in terms of the information that stood out to you that you feel like would be particularly onerous if this were combined with the shorter reporting period?
I mean, I think, you know, job titles is obviously an issue, but then also just keeping track of every individual that you speak to within a department makes it a little bit more difficult, especially when I think Beverly mentioned this as well, just needing, you know, especially if you're on the go, needing to quickly, you know, jot down who you spoke to, when, and all that. And I guess I don't really see the difference in saying, hey, these people, we lobbied on this matter for this client, you know, we lobbied DWP. I don't know, I don't really see the difference between just reporting that and then specifically listing out the individuals and the titles within the DWP that we talked to.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll be moving on to caller with phone number ending in 343. Caller with phone number ending in 343, if you can please dial *6 to unmute. And please state your name for the record. If you can also spell it, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Hello, can you all hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Derek Furr. That's spelled D-E-R-E-K, last name F-U-R-R. And firstly, you know, thank you to the commission for your time. I am a political treasurer and compliance specialist, and I'm responsible for preparing two LA City lobbying firm reports and two lobbyist employer reports each quarter. And so I just wanted to speak today on a couple issues that I see from my perspective on the proposed changes to the lobbying law. The first being that to require lobbyists to report names and titles of city officials and employees or the dates of such contacts would be extremely burdensome. It's unrealistic to require lobbyists to keep track of each and every separate email, text message, or phone call that they might have with city officials or employees. You know, we work with folks who talk to or text or otherwise contact city employees every day as part of their job. And to be able to accurately keep track of all of these contacts would be extremely difficult and unrealistic to expect. Moreover, asking lobbyists to list job titles of city employees is also, I believe, unnecessary and burdensome. You know, as previous callers have mentioned, exact job titles may not be known or may change without notice. And, you know, I feel that the current law requiring city department or city council office contacted to provide adequate information to the public about lobbying activities. The public learns just as much about a lobbyist's activities by being told which department the lobbyist is lobbying, as opposed to, you know, requiring specific names and especially job titles as well. So implementing proposed changes in this area would lead to less compliance and less accurate reporting to the public. Another big concern that I have taken in tandem with the increased information burden is 20 days is simply not enough time to prepare these reports. You know, the proposed 20-day turnaround for completing lobbying reports is it's just not practical. We are often strained to prepare reports on time in the current quarterly time frame. You know, we have to collect information from our firms. You know, lobbying entities have to make certain that they have adequate backup documentation for all the information that they list in the report. There's just so many missing pieces to secure in such short time. And, you know, to shorten that window even more would just be a great burden on our end. And so, you know, finally, the shortening the reporting window isn't justified by any compelling public policy interest. You know, the public doesn't benefit much from making information available a mere 10 days earlier in exchange for a significant burden being imposed on the end of the compliance folks who are preparing these reports. So thank you to Commission for your time, and thank you for taking comments on this matter.
Thank you. Caller with phone number ending in 850, phone number ending in 850, you now have the floor. If you can please state your name for the record, and if you can spell it for us, that would also be helpful.
Hi, my name is J.P. Fisher, J-P-F-I-S-H-E-R. I'm calling on behalf of the Sutton Law Firm. We represent a variety of nonprofit organizations in Los Angeles and are deeply concerned with the proposed lobbying law. In particular, the definition of indirect lobbying proposed on page 22 of the 2018 recommendation in attachment A. This has to do with specifically grassroots lobbying. In the prior proposal in 2018, the commissioners did not discuss in any of the meetings the grassroots lobbying disclosure rules. Grassroots lobbying includes things like social media campaigns or purchasing Los Angeles Times advertisements. that urge people to contact their local council persons about pending city hall matters. The proposed definition of indirect lobbying is simply too overbroad and vague. It includes things like research and studies conducted as a part of indirect lobbying. But this would require our nonprofits, which we represent, to spend time, that spend time researching solutions to things like the city housing problems or preparing studies on the city's response to COVID. They would have to register and file lobbying reports, which is simply an onerous burden. And it would potentially subject them to penalties, which they aren't prepared for. This requirement would also increase the number of filings exponentially without increasing any relevant disclosures to the public. This isn't, studies on these things aren't as important, while also creating a trap for the unwary, because nonprofits conducting policy research have no reason to know that they should be filing lobbying reports. It is not that way in almost any other jurisdiction. Instead, the city should adopt more specific and clear definitions of indirect lobbying. Specifically, we recommend that the city look to other jurisdictions. San Francisco has a definition of grassroots lobbying, which limits lobbying to soliciting, requesting, or urging other persons to communicate directly with a city official in order to influence a matter. A definition like that would be much more narrow, but still get to the point of what the indirect lobbying clause is supposed to get to. It will still disclose grassroots lobbying, but it won't encompass nonprofits and burden nonprofits to require them to file as lobbyists when they're just simply conducting policy research. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Looks like we have one more comment. If we have additional comments, please go ahead and dial *9 to raise your hand. Otherwise, we'll go ahead and move on now with caller phone number ending in 878. Phone number ending in 878. If you can please dial *6 to unmute and state your name for the record. If you can also spell it, that would be helpful.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Chris Larson. That's K-R-I-S-L-A-R-S-O-N. And I am the president and CEO of the Hollywood Partnership, and I'm here to talk about bids today. Our bid was first established in 1996 and has been renewed 4 times and is now one of the largest bids in the state of California. And to start, I feel compelled to mention that bids are a fairly common tool used in urban places across the globe. Originating in one of Toronto's commercial corridors over 50 years ago, there are now more than 1,200 bids in North America and hundreds more in cities across the globe. On a technical level, bids are simply a financing mechanism enabled by states and created by cities. The motivation to form a bid comes from the recognition that urban places, especially given the complexity of having hundreds of different property owners, exist in a complicated web of competing interests and often experience severe issues of absenteeism and neglect. Layered with declining municipal services and challenges in managing the public realm, this was the recipe for flight, blight, and decline, which was the story for nearly every major American city in the 1970s and 80s, and motivation for many to form bids. Bids come in many different shapes and sizes, and importantly, serve many different purposes for their individual communities. It is the unmet needs of the community that shapes a bid's purpose. Some examples, in Anchorage, Alaska, its bid has a major program rescuing homeless and inebriated persons passed out on sidewalks during the bitter cold of the night. In Pittsburgh, its bid has a major focus on installing decorative lighting on its buildings and bridges to help to create an iconic reputation. In New York City, a bid was used to transform Bryant Park, then known as Needle Park, from a haven for drug users and into one of the most famous public spaces on the planet. In effect, it is a desire for particular services and outcomes that causes property owners to pool together to create something that cities cannot do on their own, but which local governments benefit from in the form of increased investment and ultimately tax collections. increased tax revenues for local governments improves their capacity to provide services to the entire jurisdiction that it serves. Los Angeles has used bids for more than two decades to improve neighborhoods and communities, leveraging contributions from all properties within a district to provide services above and beyond those provided by the city. In this, all properties contribute, public, private, and nonprofit. In this way, bids do not represent a particular interest. Rather, they are a tool created by the city to simply help improve neighborhoods. The city itself is a rate-paying contributor to many bids, including our own in Hollywood. And speaking of Hollywood, in our community, our bid provides services that the city does not. Those include power washing sidewalks, sweeping the streets, and sidewalks, emptying waste receptacles in the public realm, planting and trimming trees, installing and maintaining decorative lighting, providing security programs to augment the role of LAPD, polishing the stars on the Walk of Fame, and much more. If we relied on city services alone, something as simple as trimming street trees would be conducted only once every 18 years. The Walk of Fame would be covered in filth and debris, a fine howdy-do for the 10 million tourists who travel from across the globe to visit Los Angeles and Hollywood and its famous stars each year. And we provide these services as a contractor to the city of LA, in that we are obligated to coordinate with city departments and agencies. Additionally, as a part of that contract, the city pledges to maintain its services within the bid area that people are already paying for. And this is what's called a baseline level of services in our world. But in a city like LA, where services are already stretched and which proclaims to operate on a complaint-based system, we couldn't do our jobs to help them maintain its then-current level of service without constantly communicating with the city on a regular basis. And like other bids, the Hollywood Partnership is governed by a board of directors, which is comprised of stakeholders from our district. All of our board and committee meetings abide by the Brown Act, and all are subject to CPRA requests. We adhere to the strictest forms of transparency available to ensure that our districts are managed responsibly. My small staff spends an average of 10 hours a month responding to CPRA requests on top of the countless hours we dedicate to ensuring that we meet the requirements of the Brown Act. These are the same laws that municipalities have entire legal teams dedicated to. In closing, over the past 20 years, I've worked at four bids in three states. In my opinion, the strongest communities are those where bids, cities, and counties view one another as partners. Each are funded by comparable taxing mechanisms, each provide complementary services, and more importantly, all recognize that they exist to improve the lives of the stakeholders who call our communities home. A great example of this partnership is from one of the four where I've previously worked, and that's Long Beach, which specifically exempted bids in its lobbying ordinance. We ask that you consider a similar exemption here in Los Angeles. Thank you very much.
Hey, Chris, are you still on the line?
Chris, you may have to unmute again by dialing star six.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Hey, Chris, this is Tyler Joseph. Thanks again for calling in. I appreciate the level of detail. I have a quick question for you. Could you tell us a little bit more about, I believe you mentioned a baseline services provision. Is that something that is part of the agreement between the bid and the city? And if so, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it differs in different cities, but you're right. It is a part of the contract that we have to manage the bid. So it specifically lives as a bullet within that contract. It basically says that the city will not stop doing its job because the bid now exists. And in some cities, that is sort of unpacked further to get into everything from the level of police service to the frequency of trash collection, as an example. In Los Angeles, our current agreement does not go into that level of detail.
Okay, got it. So that's not something that says, for example, as a result of us entering into this agreement, the city will sort of be on call in a way that's above and beyond what they typically are for, you know, areas outside the bid. It's just saying that they are not going to stop providing the typical level of service because the bid exists.
That's exactly right. And I'll also mention that I think it's also a part of the concern in stakeholders informing bids is that they are going to be charged twice for, you know, maintaining a certain level of service, which is why you see in the process of forming a bid a lot of emphasis on that clause to at least create some expectation that the city, at the very least, just keep doing what it was already doing before the bid started.
Okay, great. Thanks very much for that information. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Okay, we will now be moving on to caller with phone number ending in 700. I do see two callers with phone number ending in 700. The caller with the raised hand, if you can please dial star 6 to unmute. If you dialed star 9 earlier to raise your hand.
Hi, this is Jim Sutton calling on behalf of the Los Angeles Lobbyist Association. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Well, as you know, the Lobbyist Association looks forward to working with staff and the commissioners on these proposed changes to the lobbying law, as it has done in the past when the commission has looked at other amendments to the lobbying law. And we will submit we already have submitted some written comments, and we will submit kind of a detailed point-by-point analysis of the proposed lobbying law within the next couple of weeks. What I would like to mention right now, and one point that I would like to get on the record, is really a kind of down in the weeds, nuts and bolts issue. And that is that the proposed lobbying law, in addition to adding more requirements to lobbyists and more information that lobbyists have to kind of maintain and report, most notably asking for the names and even the job titles of the city officials that are contacted, the proposal leaves in place all of the information which is currently required. And I was very happy to hear an earlier commentator talking about the kind of the conflict between quicker, more immediate disclosure, and lengthier forms. And I think the city certainly might have an interest in having reports filed less than every 4 months, but in that case, it has to be willing to eliminate or look more closely at some of the questions that are being asked now, all of which, again, were just carried over from the old lobbying law, and importantly, were never discussed at a commission meeting when this came up in 2015 and 2016. For example, the law requires lobbying firms to disclose the salaries of their employees, dividing between those employees that qualify as lobbyists and those that don't. This is incredibly difficult to maintain, and I can't go into why it's so difficult to calculate these numbers in 3 minutes. But that's not really an adequate or accurate measure of how active a lobbying firm is. The accurate measure of how active a lobbying firm is the money that it gets from its clients. And that's why every lobbying law in the nation only asks lobbying firms to disclose fees earned from clients and not these other two questions, which are salaries of lobbyists and salaries of non-lobbyist employees. Again, it really is kind of unnecessary. The forms require lobbying entities to disclose charitable donations made at a city official's request. They're sometimes called behested donations, even though the city officials are also filing different forms disclosing that exact same information. The lobbying law and the proposal wants lobbying firms to disclose both the amount that the firm has billed to the client during the quarter and the amount which it's received. Again, why both? It just leads to accounting and auditing issues and the potential for error. But this is not an exhaustive list. Again, the staff and the commission did not take any time 4 years ago to look at all of the existing requirements. And again, the Lobbyist Association might support more frequent reporting if the commission was willing to eliminate some of these kind of unnecessary and duplicative reporting questions. And just very quickly, I also just want to put one other issue on the record, because I don't know that other commentators are going to be willing to talk about, and that's the requirement for disclosing fundraising activities. Again, existing law, not analyzed by the staff or commission 4 years ago, very onerous, very complicated, very vague. The proposed law and the existing law requires lobbying entities to disclose the exact number of emails sent out when they're raising money for a candidate. The proposed law and the existing law requires lobbying entities to file a copy of a fundraising invitation, even an email, with the commission within 1 day, even though, to the extent these invitations are currently filed, in our opinion and experience, the only people looking at those are the candidate and the candidate's opponents, and probably the lobbyist competitors. If the city, it's certainly legitimate for the city to ask lobbying entities about their fundraising activities, but again, the city could do it in a way that gets information to the public without imposing these incredibly detailed, arcane, complicated, vague, and overbroad requirements on lobbying entities. For instance, do what the city of San Diego does. Did you fundraise for any city candidates during the quarter or during the two-month period? Yes, no. What's the name of the candidate? That's what the public needs to know. If the public knows that this lobbying firm, this trade association, this labor union were fundraising for a particular candidate, then they're armed with the information they need to analyze what that person is lobbying on. Just providing the name of the candidate, not the number of emails, the actual invitation, did they host an event, did they send out an email, all of that is just an unnecessary burden that really does not add anything to the public information equation. So again, the Lobby Association, you know, these are just some of the concerns the Lobby Association has with the proposal, and we'll be following up these comments. We might submit comments at the next interested persons meeting as well with more detailed written comments. Of course, let us know if you have any questions, and thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Jim, this is David. I did want to clarify something because I think on several occasions when on your comments, you've said that the staff or the commission did not discuss these issues. If these were issues of concern to you, you absolutely had plenty of opportunity during various meetings to raise these issues. So I just want to be clear that I don't think it's correct to say that these weren't discussed. If these were issues of concern, there was opportunity by anyone to raise these issues and bring them to the commission and have the decision, the commission weigh in on those.
Let me clarify the record, and let me clarify misunderstanding. We certainly had conversations with the three or four staffers that worked on this issue 5 or 6 years ago about all of the reporting requirements I talked about. But none of those issues were ever raised to the commission level. When the last time, again, this is a long time ago, but last time the staff divided the various parts of the lobbying law into topics, and the commission would talk about one or two topics at a particular meeting. And these very kind of detailed nuts and bolts reporting problems, which I agree, and I apologize if I misspoke. We did have conversations with staff about these issues. Staff, you know, just rejected our concerns, which I guess has the right to do, but they were never discussed by the commission. That really is the point that we want to make certain that's made, because we want to make certain, and I think that your staff is generally doing a good job. We don't think it's fair to give the impression to the commissioners that every single provision of this proposal was fully vetted 5 years ago, because that's not true.
Well, I would disagree with you because we had the public meetings and our commissioners attended some of those public meetings. And all the comments at the public meetings were provided to the commissioners. So if...
Liar!
Oh, well,
I don't know what that background noise was.
Well, you and I are the only ones that are muted, so I think we know where that came from. But I don't think it's fair to convey those. Those, you guys had an opportunity. We conveyed, and the commissioners had several meetings that they participated in and were this. This is absolutely another opportunity to raise this issue. I just think it's important for the record to be clear of that. And I want to go back to the other issue that was raised earlier in terms of the major filers, indirect lobbyists. Again, for clarification purposes, the San Francisco law does require things like public relations, media relations, advertising, public outreach, research, investigation, reports, analysis, studies, and to the extent all activities conducted towards their reporting requirement. So someone from your staff earlier said that San Francisco does not require things like research to counts towards that $25,000 reporting threshold, and they do. So I just think it's important to clarify so we all know what other jurisdictions are doing when we're having these discussions.
Sure, David, I appreciate that, and I pulled out the San Francisco law in front of me. So the distinction there, and what I believe the earlier caller said, was that the LA law does not, San Francisco says reports and studies may be reportable, but only if they are related to urging other persons to communicate directly with an officer of the city and county to influence local legislative action. San Francisco law, LA, again, we brought this issue up. There was a meeting where 50 nonprofits made comments begging the commission to adopt this more specific definition, and the staff completely rejected it last time. Is the proposed law doesn't limit it to grassroots lobbying, doesn't limit it to urging the public to contact. That's the whole point. The earlier law in the law is drafted, and ignoring all these comments by the nonprofit community 5 years ago is just this open-ended, you do a study on a city issue, you have to file a report. Whereas what San Francisco says is that you only have to disclose the cost of that study if it is for the purpose of, quote, urging other persons to communicate directly with an officer of the city and county.
Jim, we discussed this last time, and it was clear. That is the application. It only applies when there is an urging or an influencing done that is similar to the current law, which is a major filer. So that's
We look forward to staff adding that clarification to the proposed law. Why wouldn't you?
Well, we think it's clear. We wouldn't ask somebody that's simply doing research and never puts up a billboard or sends out an email to file anything with us. There would be no requirement. That's not a requirement in the current law. It's not a requirement in the proposed law. It's only if you're urging someone to do some action with that work. It's similar to what the lobbying law is, that you count that activity towards the monetary threshold. Once you meet those, then you have to report that activity. But if you don't,
that's great, and I'm glad this is recorded, David, because again, it's really important, I think, for the commissioners to understand that it's great. Like Mark Lowe is great. It's great when a staffer will give advice over a phone, saying, "Oh no, you don't have to report that because you never put up a billboard." But when the language of the law doesn't contain that limitation, and when another law, San Francisco, both talks about studies and does have that limiting language, then the filer is left with put into a difficult position because the law on its face could require the cost of that report to be disclosed. And David, if it's so clear to you, why would you not just adopt the language in San Francisco, which you held up as the model? And San Francisco is not the only other place.
I didn't hold up San Francisco as the model. Your office did. What I would
a lot of places just say have that language, urging residents to communicate directly with the city. Why not? I could do it right now in the major fire definition. If the study report blah 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 is for the purpose of urging residents to contact city officials about a pending or proposed municipal legislation.
Well, right. Again, this is your what you're asking is simply that everyone can have the same language as other jurisdictions. A jurisdiction has the right to draft language which it seems appropriate. Every city attorney in every city drafts language the way they feel it's appropriate. This didn't go anywhere at the last time. Once we get to a point of clarification, or if we need to clarify, we would more than be glad to do that. I wanted to clarify that that's the context, because the context that was given was that simply conducting research and not doing any kind of influencing meant that you had to report something, which was not the case.
But David, I'm just going to, and we can go back and forth, and I don't think that serves any purpose, but what's being analyzed here is the law. It is not how Mark Lowe or David Tristan is saying,
the law does not
have the limitation that you... it's great. I mean, it makes sense.
I don't think we need to continue this. This is simply your interpretation of the law and our staff's and commissioner's interpretation of the law, since that is what that was adopted. If the commissioners believe that there's additional clarification, this is absolutely something we can revisit. In addition to that, anything that gets drafted and moved forward by our board has to go before the council and ultimately has to be relooked at by the city attorney. So I think if that's it, we can move on to the next caller.
Okay. Just a minute here. And I'd like to go ahead and make another clarification. I did hear a couple of people mention that the comments that are made may not be forwarded directly to our commissioners or have not been in the past. And just to clarify that, every single time that we receive a public comment, whether it's in a public forum such as this one or via email or otherwise, if it's a public comment that is being accepted for the purpose of gathering your input, it is absolutely 100% forwarded to our ethics commissioners with all of the other public comments that are solicited at that time. Just wanted to clarify that. So if we can go ahead and move on now to caller with phone number ending in 403. Caller with phone number ending in 403. If you can please dial *6 to unmute yourself. And please state your name for the record.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Well, here we are. It took the FBI 3 years, 4 state offices, 64 federal agents, 19 prosecutors, 16 analysts to get you here today to the fucking table. Let's give everybody a hand. Yeah, you want to talk to the people now, huh? How about when you guys took that police officer, the openly gay police officer, and sat him in front of your execution squad to fine him $10,000 and forced him to retire early because he made what turned out to be a lawful arrest?
Excuse me, that's irrelevant subject matter. If we can keep our public comments respectful and on topic, please. I will go ahead and unmute. And if you have a public comment that is pertinent to the subject matter, then please go ahead and continue. Otherwise, we will move on to the next caller. So you can go ahead and dial *6 to unmute again. Again, if we can please keep it respectful and on topic. A caller with phone number ending in 403, if you can please dial *6 to unmute yourself. Okay, we will be moving on to caller with phone number ending in 994. caller with phone number ending in 994, please dial *6 to unmute yourself. Caller with phone number ending in 994, please dial *6. Okay, we're gonna go ahead and try that one more time. Caller with phone number ending in 994, if you can please dial *6 to unmute yourself and state your name for the record. Okay, we'll come back to you. Caller with phone number ending in 006. Phone number ending in 006, if you can please dial *6 to unmute. Okay, and if anybody has additional comments, if you can please dial *9 to raise your hand. Again, please dial *9 to raise your hand if you have a comment, and we're going to go ahead and try to get back to caller with phone number ending in 994. If you can please dial *6 to unmute.
Yes.
Caller with phone number ending in 994.
Hello. Sorry.
Yes, if you can please state your name for the record, and if you can spell it, that would also be helpful. Thank you.
Yes, hello. Apologies for not being able to get on earlier. I was having some difficulties, but my name is Sean McMorris, McMorris, and I'm calling on behalf of California Common Cause. And first, I'm going to read a prepared statement, and then in the spirit of public discourse, just address some of the comments that have been made about particular clauses in the amended MLO. So with that in mind, in general, California Common Cause supports the proposed amendments to the MLO. They are comprehensive and address issues of clarity and scope, as well as potential loopholes in the current outdated MLO. The proposed amendments also provide greater transparency, which is essential for public trust in democratic institutions. I will note that California Common Cause is still researching some elements of the proposed amendments to the MLO, and we will be submitting a written opinion for the public record at a later time. Thus, my comments here today will be general in nature. With that in mind, the impetus for an updated MLO is correct, as are the end goals of the proposed amendments, which are greater trust and accountability in Los Angeles government. Lobbying has a proper place in democracy, perhaps even an integral place. But the breadth and scope of lobbying does matter. Guardrails are necessary, especially when those with greater means have greater lobbying power and, by extension, greater influence over electeds and policy. I would ask that the Commission keep this in mind when matters of burden are invoked as justification for less transparency in the amended MLO. Democracy is not unburdensome. On the contrary, democracy is inherently burdensome upon all involved, but particularly the public, because a well-functioning democracy requires maximum participation. But when participation is easier for a select few who have greater means and access, barriers to participation are then erected for those with lesser means. So erodes trust in a democratic process, and with it, efficacy of a democratic system. A meaningful MLO provides transparency, but it does more than that. because transparency in this instance is a way to level the playing field. It's a way to hold our representatives accountable. And yes, it is a check on corruption. Some do not want this word associated with the MLO, but any laws that deal with ethics, transparency, and accountability inherently deal with corruption or the potential for corruption as well. While the extent of reporting requirements and who is encompassed in the MLO should be carefully considered so as not to impose unreasonable or undue burdens upon the lobbying process, it is concurrently apt to demand that with greater lobbying power comes greater responsibility. If you meet the thresholds of robust paid lobbying in the amended MLO, then you should be prepared to take on the burden of providing more transparency. In closing, California Common Cause supports greater transparency and accountability in government and a level playing field for participation in the democratic process. We believe the proposed amendments further these principles at Los Angeles City Hall. The amendments are reasonable and in some instances much needed. We support the amendments in general and will provide further feedback in the near future. With that said, if I have time, I would like to just briefly address some of the other comments about sections of the MLO.
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. And forgive me if I've misinterpreted anyone's comment or if I'm misinterpreting the amendments to the MLO. I wrote down some notes while I was listening, and one of the comments was that 20 days to report was not sufficient time. I would push back on that a little bit to the extent that I think that the report submitted by the Ethics Department that outlines the amendments and their rationale did a very good job of providing sources of other cities who have similar policies. So there's nothing unique here. And I think it's simply a matter of if you know you now are going to have 20 days instead of 40 days or 30 days, you adjust and you let your clients know that this is the new, and you prepare in advance. And I think I even remember reading something within that report that some studies have shown that reporting actually got more accurate and fines were reduced because, treasurers, for lack of a better word, were, required to have their ducks in a row and engage in this process more often. So there were actually fewer errors. On the matter of the requirement of having to report the name of the person you spoke with as well as the department they're in, I don't particularly see this as overly burdensome. I also think that this is as much a clause that is needed for enforcement as much as transparency. Los Angeles City Hall is huge. Departments are huge. So if you just say, I spoke, with, the Ethics Department, we don't know too much about that. But in terms of enforcement, it's important to know who was spoken to within that department. So, I look at that as much as an enforcement issue as transparency issue. In terms of the indirect lobbying, it was implied. One comment was made that I think some people, including myself, would take issue with equating indirect lobbyists, as they're defined in the amendments, as grassroots grassroots lobbying. If you have the money to buy a billboard and ask people to essentially lobby for you, that's pretty relevant for the public to know, and it speaks to your ways and means, which is much greater than the average person. So I think that the new definition is very good. I think it's very needed, and I would push back pretty hard on those who think that it has nothing to do with lobbying. I think it's actually potentially a loophole if you don't put language like this in here. Anytime large sums of money are involved to influence policy, whether it be my mailing you a mass mailing, say, contact your Congress or your council members to support XYZ policy, I, as a member of the public, have a right to know how much money you spent and who you are. In terms of the chair, I just have two more. Apologies. Charitable donations. It was brought up that, you know, it's not necessary for both the lobbyist and the, you know, the politician to report fundraising activities. Again, I take the opposite position of that. It's another level of transparency. And in terms of enforceability, you know, potentially a lobbyist reports a donation and a politician doesn't. And having these on record, another level of transparency allows, you know, for that discrepancy to be corrected, you know, potentially before it becomes a fine. And finally, it was mentioned about the fundraising activities clause being too onerous, and that nobody looks at those reports other than the givers and receivers of those contributions. I disagree. Watchdog groups, nonprofit good government organizations like Common Cause, we look at those filings, and I think it's very important. Again, anytime money is involved, especially political contributions, the more transparency, the better. And I'll also say, in terms of the amount of what is to be reported, emails and whatnot, again, not only is it help aid in enforcement, but context matters. Just saying that Union XYZ fundraised for council member John Doe, yes, it lets me know that they're fundraising for him, but to the extent and that they're fundraising, you know, their emails and their invites can give me insight into how much influence they have. So I think all of those things matter. And at the end of the day, we would err on the side of greater transparency than less. That's all I have. Thanks for the time. If you have any questions, happy to answer them.
Thank you for your comment. Okay, before we take our next caller, I would like to make a reminder to please, I think all of our callers have been keeping their comments on topic, except for one, if we can please just be reminded to please keep comments on topic, otherwise they will not be heard. And with that, caller with phone number ending in 006, please dial *6 to unmute. Caller with phone number ending in 006, please dial *6 to unmute. Okay, if we have any additional public comments, if you can please dial *9 to raise your hand. Okay, another call for additional comments. Please dial *9 if you'd like to make a comment. Seeing that we have no additional comments, this will conclude this special meeting. And please do rest assured that every comment that was heard here and at yesterday's meeting and that will be heard at tomorrow's meeting will be forwarded to our ethics commissioners. Every member of the ethics commission will get an opportunity to read what you have to say. Okay, seeing that we don't have any other comments, no raised hands at this time, you may provide further comment on the Ethics Commission's website at ethics.lacity.org/policy or by emailing us at ethics.policy@lacity.org. Again, we will be holding another special meeting for continued feedback tomorrow. And for details on that, please visit our website at ethics.lacity.org/meetings. David and Tyler will also be joining us at those meetings. And Tyler, if you have anything else that you'd like to add here in closing, otherwise that would conclude this meeting.
No, I think that's it for me. I just want to say thanks one final time for everybody that's still on the line for showing up and participating. Like Nancy said, all of these comments make their way to our commissioners. They get a chance to hear directly from everybody who wants to weigh in. So we really appreciate you being here. We appreciate the detail and all the comments, all the thought that you put into it. And if you'd like to attend the meeting tomorrow, you're welcome to do that. But otherwise, that's it from us. So thanks again.
The recording has stopped.